The week on the road, it was approaching the border with Libya, where the government had made it clear it was backing the effort wholeheartedly. As the vehicles crossed over the international border line, they were met with a grand official reception, in a clear effort by the Libyans to extend a hand of friendship. And it wasn't long before the British had warmed to the hospitality.
It's a tremendous response from the people of Libya thus far, and I imagine it's going to be like this throughout our journey. It's a long passage across Libya, and it'll be foreshortened by this kind of hospitality.
But it was the announcement that the Libyan government was to take the unprecedented step of providing material support to the convoy by adding extra vehicles to its number that really impressed those present.
Now, all the people here in Libya and the Islamic society in Britain are joining together today. We will have a very big convoy saying to the world that we are standing beside our people in Palestine.
These trucks, they're just awesome. They're on a different level.
Credit to the Libyans.
In total, 100 large trucks were to join the British from Libya, doubling the size of the convoy and adding over 4,000 tons of aid to its manifest.
We had a critical mass when we got to Libya because we had mass popular support and really enthusiastic government support, and genuine and practical government support, so that our convoy doubled in size, for example.
By now, the consensus amongst the volunteers from Britain was that the Libyan government and the Gaddafi Foundation had really outdone themselves in their support of the mission. But in yet another pleasant surprise, Libya broke ranks with its North African neighbours over the kind of route offered to the convoy across its territory. While Morocco, Algeria and Tunisia had, for the most part, kept Viva Palestina out of the main cities, Libyan police guided the convoy straight into the heart of Tripoli, despite the traffic jams that resulted. And while security forces in previous countries had penned in the convoy and kept a very close eye on its activities, here the approach was far more liberal, with the police focusing on clearing the path ahead.
We had a police escort which was very, very courteous and which you genuinely felt was there to help us rather than for any other purpose.
As Viva Palestina approached Tripoli, the Libyan people and the security forces were as one as they cheered the ambulances, vans and trucks through their streets.
Not only were the local people encouraged to come out and greet us, the authorities as well were obviously very happy to see us. It was the only country we went through where they encouraged and welcomed us to drive through the capital.
Some critics described the Libyan government's approach as a public relations effort, but by adding material aid to the convoy, Libya was in fact risking strained relations with its neighbour Egypt, which had in turn been under pressure from Israel over Viva Palestina.
I think it's more to do with, I wouldn't call it a U-turn, but a change, of course, in the attitude of the Libyan government over this last couple of years and continuing until now.
One of the happier chapters of the Viva Palestina journey was coming to an end. The Egyptian border lay ahead, and beyond that, the unknown. The Egyptian government was officially welcoming the convoy, but there were signs that not all was as it seemed.
The ruling party in Egypt, the NDP, had taken a view that it would deal with the convoy by embracing the convoy, at the same time as there was an evident concern on their part that we would meet the NDP but not meet any of the other parties and political forces in Egypt, of which there are many. Egypt is a populous country, a very sophisticated country and so on.
And as we entered Egyptian border control, we were promptly told to turn the camera off. then began the most comprehensive and detailed security checks that the convoy members had experienced on their entire journey. Several individuals were taken away for questioning or simply held back with no explanation given. One of them was Press TV's Yvonne Ridley.
There was a slight feeling of trepidation, and I handed my passport in. I was one of the first people to arrive at the Egyptian border and one of the last people to leave. They kept me waiting for 2 hours without explanation while everyone else was processed, and eventually they did let me go through. Four people didn't make it. Four men from the northwest of England were prevented from going through. They weren't given a reason why, and they were left stranded at the Libyan border. It was a very unfortunate incident. We felt it was designed to try and provoke a reaction, or it was sent as a signal not to mess with the Egyptian authorities.
They've cleared him through Ramsgate and everything.
Well, I was just counting. We've cleared six different countries, yeah, and not one has blinked an eyelid.
The issue of the four men who were denied entry into the country served to seriously strain relations between convoy members and the Egyptian authorities, with the Egyptian government refusing to comment. All four had been popular figures within the volunteer group.
They're on the Libyan side, which is a good thing. So the next thing we can do is try and sort out, an interpreter and some maybe Libyan diplomat or some kind of negotiations like that, really.
The early run-in with the authorities was only a sign of what was yet to come. Egypt was the final stage in the long journey to Rafah, but would also present the convoy's toughest challenges yet.
They're members of my group, which is from Manchester, and they are extremely gutted on the scenario that they're being used as chess pieces in this political game.
Efforts to get the four men back on the convoy had eventually failed.
The Egyptian authorities haven't really given us any particular reason on why they have been sent home, just that they feel like it. As far as we know, they just feel like it. There's no reason. It's not that they're on any political blacklist or they've been up to any activities.
Angry but determined not to allow the setback to divide them, the volunteer drivers decided to push forward, with only a few hundred kilometres left to the final crossing at Rafah. The convoy operation was now more than triple its original size, with the addition of the Libyan trucks and a massive Egyptian security presence. And progress was slow.
They escorted the convoy, sometimes at breakneck speed through towns and villages, and other times at agonizingly slow paces, maybe 10, 15 kilometers an hour we'd be traveling.
I would say per person we must have had at least 7, 8 national security officers plus stroke army.
I don't know if it was designed to intimidate or this is what the reality is of a police state, but it was certainly not a welcoming experience.
And while all of this was going on, another diplomatic crisis was brewing behind the scenes. As Egypt came under Israeli pressure to divert the convoy through an Israeli border control to reach Gaza, rather than take the direct route through the Rafah crossing.
Egypt's peace agreement with Israel and its relationship to the United States means that its room for maneuver is heavily circumscribed. And somehow we had to steer our way through these two things.
There was growing anxiety about the road ahead. Many organizations and governments had failed to get their aid to Gaza through Rafah in the past.
The backlog of aid, much of which has now gone off and is spoiled, stretches all the way back to Al Arish and a mountain as big as Everest in the sports stadium there. So I've no doubt that Israel was pressuring Egypt, but so equally were their own people and the feelings of the great people of Egypt that this was an unseemly role for Egypt to play gatekeeper for the Israeli occupation.
It was with mixed feelings then that the convoy finally sat down inside a compound in the town of Al-Arish, tantalizingly close to the Rafah crossing, on the eve of their planned arrival in Gaza.
Just 40 kilometers from here is the Rafah border crossing, the final hurdle in the face of the British and Libyan Viva Palestina aid convoy.
It was the day they'd all been waiting for. If all went to plan, the British and Libyan convoy would be crossing into the Gaza Strip in just a few hours. The atmosphere was electric.
I'm very excited. As soon as we cross the border into Egypt, my level of excitement is just out of control. I'm very, very excited. I can almost taste it. We're almost there.
The energy and anxiety here right now before we cross the border is unbelievable. I can't really describe it.
But that excitement turned into frustration when the police and convoy organisers couldn't come to an agreement on how to proceed. The Egyptian police wanted to break up the vehicles into small groups for the final stretch to the border. But the convoy volunteers, who'd by now learned to distrust the authorities, felt it may have been a ploy to dismantle the initiative altogether.
Well, they're saying now they're going to take us in fives and tens. You know, we left Britain as a convoy, and we're going to stick, we're going to all stick together, we're going to all unite this time.
All of us together, we're not moving from here, 5 weeks.
In the meantime, George Galloway had raced ahead to oversee the Rafah crossing.
Well, the Egyptian government was trying to hurry me over the border into Rafah. The Palestinian side, not knowing exactly what was happening on the other side, were keen for me to go through. But I made it clear that I'd come all this way with a convoy and I wasn't walking through on foot without it. The convoy, meanwhile, was parked up in a rather sordid car park in Al-Arish, having some difficulties with the Egyptian police.
The situation in Al-Arish had developed into a standoff. Neither side was willing to compromise.
We're not letting us through. We're not letting us go.
And as patience ran out, some convoy members took their fate into their own hands and removed the police barricades blocking their vehicles. Chaos ensued as the police tried to regain control, while the convoy drivers forced their way out and attempted to make it to Rafah. Hundreds of riot police who'd been accompanying the convoy since it entered Egypt were sent in, and the bid for freedom turned into a bloody street battle.
The police moved in, they were repelled, and then the riot squad moved in.
They want to get in. They ain't getting in, bro.
Blows were exchanged as people tried to defend themselves against this brutal reaction by the Egyptian authorities.
Meanwhile, Press TV had been trying to transmit the images, but found its outside broadcast vehicle, which was embedded with the convoy, had been sabotaged so that it could no longer send out footage. And the vehicles that had managed to escape during the clashes didn't get very far. The Egyptian police held them at roadblocks not far from the compound, and some drivers say they were beaten and had their keys snatched.
We got the key. Look, sit down, sit down. Alhamdulillah, we got the keys back. We got the camera back. Now everybody go to their vehicles. Get into your vehicles.
As convoy leaders tried to bring order to anarchy, the police moved more large barricades into place and again blocked the vehicles in the compound.
Yeah. It's just a typical Sunday morning, with birds flying, sun up high, all enjoying ourselves. You know, we got our deck chairs out, you know, a few drinks, and yeah, it's been fine. Nothing much other than that. Just go through YouTube in a couple of days, and I'm sure you'll see exactly what happened there.
Tensions had eventually calmed, and there was even a chance for football, although the offer of a match in which Viva Palestina took on the Egyptian police was declined by the authorities. The Egyptians had unwittingly strengthened the resolve of the convoy.
They managed to unite the whole convoy, and the team spirit that we had so desperately sought during each leg of the convoy suddenly emerged in Alarish, and everybody became as one.
But it was when darkness fell that evening that things started to get really disturbing. A group of unidentified men vandalized some of the Viva Palestina vans. When the convoy volunteers tried to confront them, they were attacked with bricks and stones. This was accompanied by a power cut, which disabled all street lighting in the area.
They outnumbered us. That's when obviously I ran up and I came. I said, look, we are under attack here. By the time we got back there, obviously we overpowered them. We managed to move them out. And then as reinforcements on their side were coming, the police were stood there and they were coming from around the police, and the police did nothing.
They were coming running from behind the police, yeah. And the police knew that they were coming. The police exactly knew who they were, and they went into that flat over there just behind the police. We told the police officer, look, one of our guys has just been attacked. Yeah, his head's cut open. Call an ambulance. It was not my job.
The attacks resulted in a number of convoy members being hospitalized. By now, many suspected the Egyptian authorities were involved, but police in the area refused to comment, other than insist that their extremely heavy presence remained for the convoy's own security, a statement that was derided by those blocked in.
I, for one, and I think you'll be with me on this, we no longer have any confidence in the security forces here to protect us. I don't know who has been writing on our vehicles. I don't know who attacked us. They are claiming to be acting in the name of a small group within Fatah that had problems with Hamas in Gaza last year. But in this part of the world, everything is not always what it seems. But the only thing that matters to me now is the safety of our people, the safety of our people, and the safety of our vehicles and what's in them. So we are now in a situation where we are blocked from leaving here. The police are everywhere, hundreds of police, but they haven't been able to stop one vehicle being damaged and one person being injured.
It was to be a long night, clouded with confusion and fear, with convoy members now taking turns to stand guard in case of any further attacks. They're using us against us. The remainder of the night had passed off relatively uneventful. The Egyptian authorities had removed substantial amounts of aid from the vehicles as part of an agreement with Israel to only allow medical aid through Rafah. But by dawn, convoy members, using a variety of methods, had managed to get the vast majority of aid back on board.
Well, I'm not sure how politic it is to go into all the details. A lot of the aid was taken off the vehicles and somehow it made it back onto the vehicles. And 95%, I would say, 90% anyway.
Battered and bruised, but with their heads held high, the convoy volunteers made their way to Rafah for the final push to Gaza. But they did so without their lead vehicle, the fire engine from Manchester, and without the now iconic Viva Palestina boat. The two had become casualties of Israel's pressure on Egypt.
They'd become symbols for the convoy, and therefore we very, very much wanted them to get through. But because they were so symbolic, I suspect that it was very important for this Israeli-Egyptian agreement that they did not go through, because it would have been seen that the Rafah border had been prized open even more.
Viva Palestina was now just meters away from its final destination, 3 weeks after its set off from London. Once again, George Galloway faced the Palestinian border, this time with the convoy close behind.
It was very emotional.
When those gates opened and we walked through, it was a magical moment.
We kissed the ground, aware that there was a kind of throbbing mass of people waiting for us just yards away. The media scrum was enormous, having been ignored by so many cameras other than press TVs for much of the journey. It was astounding to see the entire world's media desperately pushing their microphones into our faces.
We traveled many miles, but the joy in our hearts as we enter this land of heroes, were embraced by heroes, is difficult to put into words.
دخول القافلة من اللحظة الأولى التي وصلت إلى معبر رفح واليوم في الكتيبة الخضراء واستلام السيارات والمعونات.
Residents of the battered and beleaguered Gaza Strip flooded onto the streets, overjoyed at finally meeting the expression of solidarity which had traveled 5,000 miles to make its point. But as Viva Palestina made its way to Gaza City, it was also met with grim reminders of why the mission had been initiated in the first place. They had made it to Gaza against all odds and at times in the face of stiff opposition. The moment had now arrived to transfer the vehicles and aid they'd brought. And in an audacious move, George Galloway personally, live on international television, handed over a substantial amount of cash to a government which had been deemed a terrorist organization by both Israel and the United States.
This is politics.
I was very clear and very careful about what I said. The word Hamas never crossed my lips. I'm not a supporter of Hamas as it happens, but I am a supporter of democracy. And I don't believe that anyone other than the Palestinians have the right to choose their own government. Neither Washington nor London, still less Tel Aviv, has the right to tell the Palestinians who represents them.
Viva Palestina had accomplished its goals. The 300 British volunteers, with millions of common people from around the world behind them, had broken the siege for a day at least. They'd refused to accept the narrative laid down by Israel and the international community. Their humble but symbolic effort reignited the issue of Palestine in the hearts of the people of North Africa and brought a new moment of hope to Gaza in the face of Israel's crushing blockade. But the story doesn't end here.
I'm going back at the head, along with some very prominent people in the United States, of a huge US convoy. And not a brick has been laid, not a pane of glass repaired. Nothing has changed. And that's the biggest scandal of them all. You see, the Palestinians can absorb that kind of attack. They can absorb the death, even, of so many people. Most of them, as you know, women and children. But it's the siege that's killing the whole people. And it's the siege that we have to break.
The fact of the matter is that international law states that people have a right to trade with the rest of the world. International law states that everyone in the world should be freely allowed to travel within their own country, to freely exit and re-enter their own country. I mean, this is international law. And it's time for the world community to begin enforcing its own standards. And if our governments aren't going to do it, then it's up to us, as individual citizens, as people of conscience, to stand up and say we are going to uphold the law.
In our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians. We are all Palestinians. We are all Palestinians.
Sing it with me now.
Just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little bears are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on little girls while they sleep in their bed. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated?